The cost of this vast illusion had been enormous, and the war with Turkey would fail. But Potemkin had accomplished his goal. To the observant, of course, there were signs along the way that all was not as it seemed. But when the Empress herself insisted that everything was real and glorious, the courtiers could only agree. This was the essence of the seduction. Catherine had wanted so deeply to be seen as a loving and progressive ruler, one who would defeat the Turks and liberate Europe, that when she saw signs of change in the Crimea, her mind filled in the picture. When our emotions are engaged, we often have trouble seeing things as they are. Feelings of love cloud our vision, making us color events to coincide with our desires. To make people believe in the illusions you create, you need to feed the emotions over which they have least control. Often the best way to do this is to ascertain their unsatisfied desires, their wishes crying out for fulfillment. Perhaps they want to see themselves as noble or romantic, but life has thwarted them. Perhaps they want an adventure. If something seems to validate this wish, they become emotional and irrational, almost to the point of hallucination. Remember to envelop them in your illusion slowly. Potemkin did not start with grand spectacles, but with simple sights along the way, such as grazing cattle. Then he brought them on land, heightening the drama until the calculated climax when the windows were flung open to reveal a mighty war machine. Actually, a few thousand men and boats lined up in such a way as to suggest many more. Like Potemkin, involve the target in some kind of journey, physical or otherwise. The feeling of a shared adventure is rife with fantasy associations. Make people feel that they are getting to see and live out something that relates to their deepest yearnings, and they will see happy, prosperous villages where there are only facades. Keys to Seduction. The real world can be unforgiving. Events occur over which we have little control. Other people ignore our feelings in their quests to get what they need. Time runs out before we accomplish what we had wanted. If we ever stopped to look at the present and future in a completely objective way, we would despair. Fortunately, we develop the habit of dreaming early on. In this other mental world that we inhabit, the future is full of rosy possibilities. Perhaps tomorrow we'll sell that brilliant idea or meet the person who will change our lives. Our culture stimulates these fantasies with constant images and stories of marvelous occurrences and happy romances. The problem is, these images and fantasies exist only in our minds or on screen. They really aren't enough. We crave the real thing, not this endless daydreaming and titillation. Your task as a seducer is to bring some flesh and blood into someone's fantasy life by embodying a fantasy figure or creating a scenario resembling that person's dreams. No one can resist the pull of a secret desire that has come to life before their eyes. You must first choose targets who have some repression or dream unrealized, always the most likely victims of a seduction. Slowly and gradually, you will build up the illusion that they are getting to see and feel and live those dreams of theirs. Once they have this sensation, they will lose contact with reality and begin to see your fantasy as more real than anything else. And once they lose touch with reality, they are, to quote Stendhal on Lord Byron's Female Victims, like roasted larks that fall into your mouth. Most people have a misconception about illusion. As any magician knows, it need not be built out of anything grand or theatrical. The grand and theatrical can, in fact, be destructive, calling too much attention to you and your schemes. Instead, create the appearance of normality. Once your targets feel secure, nothing is out of the ordinary, you have room to deceive them. Pei Pu didn't spin the lie about his gender immediately. He took his time, made Boursicot come to him. Once Boursicot had fallen for it, Pei Pu continued to wear men's clothes. In animating a fantasy, the great mistake is imagining it must be larger than life. That would border on camp, which is entertaining but rarely seductive. Instead, what you aim for is what Freud called the uncanny, something strange and familiar at the same time, like a déjà vu or a childhood memory, anything slightly irrational and dreamlike. The uncanny, the mix of the real and the unreal, has immense power over our imaginations. The fantasies you bring to life for your targets should not be bizarre or exceptional. They should be rooted in reality, with a hint of the strange, the theatrical, the occult, in talk of destiny, for example. You vaguely remind people of something in their childhood, or a character in a film or book. Even before Boursicot heard Peipu's story, he had the uncanny feeling of something remarkable and fantastical in this normal-looking man. The secret to creating an uncanny effect is to keep it subtle and suggestive. Emma Hart came from a prosaic background, her father a country blacksmith in 18th-century England. Emma was beautiful, but had no other talents to her credit. Yet she rose to become one of the greatest seductresses in history, seducing first Sir William Hamilton, the English ambassador to the court of Naples, and then, as Lady Hamilton, Sir William's wife, Vice Admiral Lord Nelson. What was strangest when you met her was an uncanny sense that she was a figure from the past, a woman out of Greek myth or ancient history. Sir William was a collector of Greek and Roman antiquities. To seduce him, Emma cleverly made herself resemble a Greek statue and mythical figures in paintings of the time. It wasn't just the way she wore her hair or dressed, but her poses, the way she carried herself. It was as if one of the paintings he collected had come to life. Soon Sir William began to host parties in his home in Naples, at which Emma would wear costumes and pose, recreating images from mythology and history. Dozens of men fell in love with her, for she embodied an image from their childhood, an image of beauty and perfection. The key to this fantasy creation was some shared cultural association, mythology, historical seductresses like Cleopatra. Every culture has a pool of such figures from the distant and not-so-distant past. You hint at a similarity in spirit and in appearance, but you are flesh and blood. What could be more thrilling than the sense of being in the presence of some fantasy figure going back to your earliest memories? One night, Pauline Bonaparte, the sister of Napoleon, held a gala affair in her house. Afterward, a handsome German officer approached her in the garden and asked for her help in passing along a request to the emperor. Pauline said she would do her best, and then, with a rather mysterious look in her eye, asked him to come back to the same spot the next night. The officer returned and was greeted by a young woman who led him to some rooms near the garden and then to a magnificent salon complete with an extravagant bath. Moments later, another young woman entered through a side door, dressed in the sheerest garments. It was Pauline. Bells were rung, ropes were pulled, and maids appeared, preparing the bath, giving the officer a dressing gown, then disappearing. The officer later described the evening as something out of a fairy tale, and he had the feeling that Pauline was deliberately acting the part of some mythical seductress. Pauline was beautiful and powerful enough to get almost any man she wanted, and she wasn't interested simply in luring a man into bed. She wanted to envelop him in romantic adventure, seduce his mind. Part of the adventure was the feeling that she was playing a role and was inviting her target along into this shared fantasy. Role-playing is immensely pleasurable. Its appeal goes back to childhood, where we first learn the thrill of trying on different parts, imitating adults or figures out of fiction. As we get older and society fixes a role on us, a part of us yearns for the playful approach we once had, the masks we were able to wear. We still want to play that game, to act a different role in life. Indulge your targets in this wish by first making it clear that you are playing a role, then inviting them to join you in a shared fantasy. The more you set things up like a play or a piece of fiction, the better. Notice how Pauline began the seduction with a mysterious request that the officer reappear the next night. Then a second woman led him into a magical series of rooms. Pauline herself delayed her entrance, and when she appeared, she did not mention his business with Napoleon or anything remotely banal. She had an ethereal air about her. He was being invited to enter a fairy tale. The evening was real, but had an uncanny resemblance to an erotic dream. Casanova took role-playing still further. He traveled with an enormous wardrobe and a trunk full of props, many of them gifts for his targets, fans, jewels, other accoutrements. And some of the things he said and did were borrowed from novels he had read and stories he had heard. He enveloped women in a romantic atmosphere that was heightened yet quite real to their senses. Like Casanova, you must see the world as a kind of theater. Inject a certain lightness into the roles you're playing. Try to create a sense of drama and illusion. Confuse people with the slight unreality of words and gestures inspired by fiction. In daily life, be the consummate actor. Our culture reveres actors because of their freedom to play roles. It is something that all of us envy. For years, the Cardinal de Rohan had been afraid that he had somehow offended his queen, Marie Antoinette. She would not so much as look at him. Then, in 1784, the Comtesse de La Motte-Valois suggested to him that the queen was prepared not only to change the situation, but actually to befriend him. The queen, said La Motte-Valois, would indicate this in her next formal reception. She would nod to him in a particular way. During the reception, Rohan indeed noticed a slight change in the queen's behavior toward him, and a barely perceptible glance at him. He was overjoyed. Now the countess suggested they exchange letters, and Rohan spent days writing and rewriting his first letter to the queen. To his delight, he received one back. Next, the queen requested a private interview with him in the gardens of Versailles. Rohan was beside himself with happiness and anxiety. At nightfall, he met the queen in the gardens, fell to the ground, and kissed the hem of her dress. "You may hope that the past will be forgotten," she said. At this moment, they heard voices approaching, and the queen, frightened that someone would see them together, quickly fled with her servants. But Rohan soon received a request from her, again through the countess. She desperately wanted to acquire the most beautiful diamond necklace ever created. She needed a go-between to purchase it for her, since the king thought it too expensive. She had chosen Rohan for the task. The cardinal was only too willing. In performing this task, he would prove his loyalty, and the queen would be indebted to him forever. Rohan acquired the necklace. The countess was to deliver it to the queen. Now Rohan waited for the queen both to thank him and slowly to pay him back. Yet this never happened. The countess was, in fact, a grand swindler. The queen had never nodded to him. He had only imagined it. The letters he had received from her were forgeries, and not even very good ones. The woman he had met in the park had been a prostitute, paid to dress and act the part. The necklace was, of course, real, but once Rohan had paid for it and handed it over to the countess, it disappeared. It was broken into parts, which were hawked all over Europe for enormous amounts. And when Rohan finally complained to the queen, news of the extravagant purchase spread rapidly. The public believed Rohan's story, that the queen had indeed bought the necklace and was pretending otherwise. This fiction was the first step in the ruin of her reputation. Everyone has lost something in life, has felt the pangs of disappointment. The idea that we can get something back, that a mistake can be righted, is immensely seductive. Under the impression that the queen was prepared to forgive some mistake he had made, Rohan hallucinated all kinds of things, nods that didn't exist, letters that were the flimsiest of forgeries, a prostitute who became Marie Antoinette. The mind is infinitely vulnerable to suggestion, and even more so when strong desires are involved. And nothing is stronger than the desire to change the past, right a wrong, satisfy a disappointment. Find these desires in your victims, and creating a believable fantasy will be simple for you. Few have the power to see through an illusion they desperately want to believe in. Reversal. There is no reversal to this chapter. No seduction can proceed without creating illusion, the sense of a world that is real but separate from reality. Chapter 15. Isolate the victim. An isolated person is weak. By slowly isolating your victims, you make them more vulnerable to your influence. Their isolation may be psychological. By filling their field of vision through the pleasurable attention you pay them, you crowd out everything else in their mind. They see and think only of you. The isolation may also be physical. You take them away from their normal milieu, friends, family, home. Give them the sense of being marginalized, in limbo. They're leaving one world behind and entering another. Once isolated like this, they have no outside support, and in their confusion, they are easily led astray. Lure the seduced into your lair, where nothing is familiar. Isolation, the exotic effect. In the early 5th century BC, Fu Chai, the Chinese king of Wu, defeated his great enemy, Go Jian, the king of Yue, in a series of battles. Go Jian was captured and forced to serve as a groom in Fu Chai's stables. He was finally allowed to return home, but every year he had to pay a large tribute of money and gifts to Fu Chai. Over the years, this tribute added up so that the kingdom of Wu prospered and Fu Chai grew wealthy. One year, Go Jian sent a delegation to Fu Chai. They wanted to know if he would accept a gift of 2 beautiful maidens as part of the tribute. Fu Chai was curious and accepted the offer. The women arrived a few days later amid much anticipation, and the king received them in his palace. The 2 approached the throne. Their hair was magnificently coiffured in what was called the cloud cluster style, ornamented with pearl ornaments and kingfisher feathers. As they walked, jade pendants hanging from their girdles made the most delicate sound. The air was full of some delightful perfume. The king was extremely pleased. The beauty of one of the girls far surpassed that of the other. Her name was Shi Shi. She looked him in the eye without a hint of shyness. In fact, she was confident and coquettish, something he wasn't used to seeing in such a young girl. Fu Chai called for festivities to commemorate the occasion. The halls of the palace filled with revelers, inflamed with wine, Shi Shi danced before the king. She sang, and her voice was beautiful. Reclining on a couch of white jade, she looked like a goddess. The king could not leave her side. The next day he followed her everywhere. To his astonishment, she was witty, sharp, and knowledgeable, and could quote the classics better than he could. When he had to leave her to deal with royal affairs, his mind was full of her image. Soon he brought her with him to his councils, asking her advice on important matters. She told him to listen less to his ministers. He was wiser than they were, his judgment superior. Shi Shi's power grew daily. Yet she was not easy to please. If the king failed to grant some wish of hers, tears would fill her eyes, his heart would melt, and he would yield. One day she begged him to build her a palace outside the capital. Of course, he obliged her. And when he visited the palace, he was astounded at its magnificence, even though he had paid the bills. Shi Shi had filled it with the most extravagant furnishings. The grounds contained an artificial lake with marble bridges crossing over it. Fu Chai spent more and more time here, sitting by a pool and watching Shi Shi comb her hair, using the pool as a mirror. He would watch her playing with her birds in their jeweled cages or simply walking through the palace, for she moved like a willow in the breeze. The months went by. He stayed in the palace. He missed councils, ignored his family and friends, neglected his public functions. He lost track of time. When a delegation came to talk to him of urgent matters, he was too distracted to listen. If anything but Shi Shi took up his time, he worried unbearably that she would be angry. Finally, word reached him of a growing crisis. The fortune he had spent on the palace had bankrupted the treasury, and the people were discontented. He returned to the capital, but it was too late. An army from the kingdom of Yue had invaded Wu and had reached the capital. All was lost. Fu Chai had no time to rejoin his beloved Shi Shi. Instead of letting himself be captured by the king of Yue, the man who had once served in his stables, he committed suicide. Little did he know that Guo Qian had plotted this invasion for years, and that Shi Shi's elaborate seduction was the main part of his plan. Interpretation. Guo Jian wanted to make sure that his invasion of Wu would not fail. His enemy was not Fu Chai's armies or his wealth and his resources, but his mind. If he could be deeply distracted, his mind filled with something other than affairs of state, he would fall like ripe fruit. Guo Jian found the most beautiful maiden in his realm. For 3 years he had her trained in all of the arts, not just singing, dancing, and calligraphy, but how to dress, how to talk, how to play the coquette. And it worked. Shi Shi did not allow Fu Chai a moment's rest. Everything about her was exotic and unfamiliar. The more attention he paid to her hair, her moods, her glances, the way she moved, the less he thought about diplomacy and war. He was driven to distraction. All of us today are kings protecting the tiny realm of our own lives, weighed down by all kinds of responsibilities, surrounded by ministers and advisors. A wall forms around us. We are immune to the influence of other people because we are so preoccupied. Like Shi Shi, then, you must lure your targets away, gently, slowly, from the affairs that fill their mind, and what will best lure them from their castles is the whiff of the exotic. Offer something unfamiliar that will fascinate them and hold their attention. Be different in your manners and appearance, and slowly envelop them in this different world of yours. Keep your targets off balance with coquettish changes of mood. Don't worry that the disruption you represent is making them emotional. That is a sign of their growing weakness. Most people are ambivalent. On the one hand, they feel comforted by their habits and duties. On the other, they're bored and ripe for anything that seems exotic, that seems to come from somewhere else. They may struggle or have doubts, but exotic pleasures are irresistible. The more you can get them into your world, the weaker they become. As with the King of Wu, by the time they realize what has happened, it's too late. Isolation, the only you effect. In 1948, the 29-year-old actress Rita Hayworth, known as Hollywood's love goddess, was at a low point in her life. Her marriage to Orson Welles was breaking up, her mother had died, and her career seemed stalled. That summer, she headed for Europe. Welles was in Italy at the time, and in the back of her mind, she was dreaming of a reconciliation. Rita stopped first at the French Riviera. Invitations poured in, particularly from wealthy men, for at the time, she was considered the most beautiful woman in the world. Aristotle Onassis and the Shah of Iran telephoned her almost daily, begging for a date. She turned them all down. A few days after her arrival, though, she received an invitation from Elsa Maxwell, the society hostess, who was giving a little party in Cannes. Rita balked, but Maxwell insisted, telling her to buy a new dress, show up a little late, and make a grand entrance. Rita played along and arrived at the party wearing a white Grecian gown, her red hair falling over her bare shoulders. She was greeted by a reaction she had grown used to. All conversation stopped as both men and women turned in their chairs, the men gazing in amazement, the women jealous. A man hurried to her side and escorted her to her table. It was 37-year-old Prince Ali Khan, the son of the Aga Khan III, who was the worldwide leader of the Islamic Ismaili sect and one of the richest men in the world. Rita had been warned about Ali Khan, a notorious rake. To her dismay, they were seated next to each other, and he never left her side. He asked her a million questions about Hollywood, her interests, on and on. She began to relax a little and open up. There were other beautiful women there, princesses, actresses, but Ali Khan ignored them all, acting as if Rita were the only woman there. He led her onto the dance floor, and though he was an expert dancer, she felt uncomfortable. He held her a little too close. Still, when he offered to drive her back to her hotel, she agreed. They sped along the Grand Corniche. It was a beautiful night. For one evening, she had managed to forget her many problems, and she was grateful, but she was still in love with Wells, and an affair with a rake like Ali Khan was not what she needed. Ali Khan had to fly off on business for a few days. He begged her to stay at the Riviera until he got back. While he was away, he telephoned constantly. Every morning, a giant bouquet of flowers arrived. On the telephone, he seemed particularly annoyed that the Shah of Iran was trying hard to see her, and he made her promise to break the date to which she had finally agreed. During this time, a gypsy fortune teller visited the hotel, and Rita agreed to have her fortune read. "You are about to embark on the greatest romance of your life," the gypsy told her. "He is someone you already know. You must relent and give in to him totally. Only if you do that will you find happiness at long last." Not knowing who this man could be, Rita, who had a weakness for the occult, decided to extend her stay. Ali Khan came back. He told her that his chateau overlooking the Mediterranean was the perfect place to escape from the press and forget her troubles, and that he would behave himself. She relented. Life in the chateau was like a fairy tale. Wherever she turned, his Indian helpers were there to attend to her every wish. At night, he would take her into his enormous ballroom where they would dance all by themselves. Could this be the man the fortune teller meant? Ali Khan invited his friends over to meet her. Among this strange company, she felt alone again and depressed. She decided to leave the chateau. Just then, as if he had read her thoughts, Ali Khan whisked her off to Spain, the country that fascinated her most. The press caught on to the affair and began to hound them in Spain. Rita had had a daughter with Wells. Was this any way for a mother to act? Ali Khan's reputation didn't help, but he stood by her, shielding her from the press as best he could. Now, she was more alone than ever, and more dependent on him. Near the end of the trip, Ali Khan proposed to Rita. She turned him down. She didn't think he was the kind of man you married. He followed her to Hollywood, where her former friends were less friendly than before. Thank God she had Ali Khan to help her. A year later, she finally succumbed, abandoning her career, moving to Ali Khan's chateau, and marrying him. Interpretation. Ali Khan, like a lot of men, fell in love with Rita Hayworth the moment he saw the film Gilda in 1948. He made up his mind that he would seduce her somehow. The moment he heard she was coming to the Riviera, he got his friend Elsa Maxwell to lure her to the party and seat her next to him. He knew about the breakup of her marriage and how vulnerable she was. His strategy was to block out everything else in her world, problems, other men, suspicion of him and his motives, etc. His campaign began with the display of an intense interest in her life. Constant phone calls, flowers, gifts, all to keep him in her mind. He set up the fortune teller to plant the seed. When she began to fall for him, he introduced her to his friends, knowing she would feel alienated among them, and therefore dependent on him. Her dependence was heightened by the trip to Spain, where she was on unfamiliar territory, besieged by reporters and forced to cling to him for help. He slowly came to dominate her thoughts. Everywhere she turned, there he was. Finally, she succumbed out of weakness and the boost to her vanity that his attention represented. Under his spell, she forgot about his horrid reputation, relinquishing the suspicions that were the only thing protecting her from him. It was not Ali Khan's wealth or looks that made him a great seducer. He wasn't, in fact, very handsome, and his wealth was more than offset by his bad reputation. His success was strategic. He isolated his victims, working so slowly and subtly that they did not notice it. The intensity of his attention made a woman feel that, in his eyes, at that moment, she was the only woman in the world. This isolation was experienced as pleasure. The woman did not notice her growing dependence, how the way he filled up her mind with his attention slowly isolated her from her friends and her milieu. Her natural suspicions of the man were drowned out by his intoxicating effect on her ego. Ali Khan almost always capped off his seductions by taking the woman to some enchanted place on the globe, a place that he knew well, but where the woman felt lost. Do not give your targets the time or space to worry about, suspect, or resist you. Flood them with the kind of attention that crowds out all other thoughts, concerns, and problems. Remember, people secretly yearn to be led astray by someone who knows where they're going. It can be a pleasure to let go, and even to feel isolated and weak, if the seduction is done slowly and gracefully. Keys to seduction. The people around you may seem strong and more or less in control of their lives, but that is merely a facade. Underneath, people are more brittle than they let on. What lets them seem strong is the series of nests and safety nets they envelop themselves in. Their friends, their families, their daily routines, which give them a feeling of continuity, safety, and control. Suddenly pull the rug out from under them, drop them alone into some foreign place where the familiar signposts are gone or scrambled, and you will see a very different person. A target who is strong and settled is hard to seduce, but even the strongest people can be made vulnerable if you can isolate them from their nests and safety nets. Block out their friends and family with your constant presence. Alienate them from the world they're used to and take them to places they do not know. Get them to spend time in your environment. Deliberately disturb their habits. Get them to do things they have never done. They will grow emotional, making it easier to lead them astray. Disguise all this in the form of a pleasurable experience, and your targets will wake up one day distanced from everything that normally comforts them. Then, they will turn to you for help, like a child crying out for its mother when the lights are turned out. In seduction, as in warfare, the isolated target is weak and vulnerable. In Samuel Richardson's Clarissa, written in 1748, the rake Lovelace is attempting to seduce the novel's beautiful heroine. Clarissa is young, virtuous, and very much protected by her family, but Lovelace is a conniving seducer. First, he courts Clarissa's sister, Arabella. A match between them seems likely. Then he suddenly switches attention to Clarissa, playing on sibling rivalry to make Arabella furious. Their brother, James, is angered by Lovelace's change in sentiments. He fights with Lovelace and is wounded. The whole family is in an uproar, united against Lovelace, who, however, manages to smuggle letters to Clarissa and to visit her when she's at the house of a friend. The family finds out and accuses her of disloyalty. Clarissa is innocent. She hasn't encouraged Lovelace's letters or visits, but now her parents are determined to marry her off to a rich, older man. Alone in the world, about to be married to a man she finds repulsive, she turns to Lovelace as the only one who can save her from this mess. Eventually, he rescues her by getting her to London where she can escape this dreaded marriage, but where she is also hopelessly isolated. In these circumstances, her feelings toward him soften. All of this has been masterfully orchestrated by Lovelace himself. The turmoil within the family, Clarissa's eventual alienation from them, the whole scenario. Your worst enemies in a seduction are often your target's family and friends. They are outside your circle and immune to your charms. They may provide a voice of reason to the seduced. You must work silently and subtly to alienate the target from them. Insinuate that they are jealous of your target's good fortune in finding you, or that they are parental figures who have lost a taste for adventure. The latter argument is extremely effective with young people whose identities are in flux and who are more than ready to rebel against any authority figure, particularly their parents. You represent excitement and life. The friends and parents represent habit and boredom. In Shakespeare's The Tragedy of King Richard III, Richard, when still the Duke of Gloucester, has murdered King Henry VI and his son, Prince Edward. Shortly thereafter, he accosts Lady Anne, Prince Edward's widow, who knows what he has done to the two men closest to her and who hates him as much as a woman can hate. Yet Richard attempts to seduce her. His method is simple. He tells her that what he did because of his love for her. He wanted there to be no one in her life but him. His feelings were so strong he was driven to murder. Of course, Lady Anne not only resists this line of reasoning, she abhors him, but he persists. Anne is at a moment of extreme vulnerability, alone in the world with no one to support her, at the height of grief. Incredibly, his words begin to have an effect. Murder is not a seductive tactic. But the seducer does enact a kind of killing, a psychological one. Our past attachments are a barrier to the present. Even people we have left behind can continue to have a hold on us. As a seducer, you will be held up to the past, compared to previous suitors, perhaps found inferior. Do not let it get to that point. Crowd out the past with your attentions in the present. If necessary, find ways to disparage their previous lovers, subtly or not so subtly, depending on the situation. Even go so far as to open old wounds, making them feel old pain and seeing, by contrast, how much better the present is. The more you can isolate them from their past, the deeper they will sink with you into the present. The principle of isolation can be taken literally by whisking the target off to an exotic locale. This was Ali Khan's method. A secluded island worked best, and indeed islands, cut off from the rest of the world, have always been associated with the pursuit of sensual pleasures. The Roman Emperor Tiberius descended into debauchery once he made his home on the island of Capri. The danger of travel is that your targets are intimately exposed to you. It's hard to maintain an air of mystery, but if you take them to a place alluring enough to distract them, you will prevent them from focusing on anything banal in your character. Cleopatra lured Julius Caesar into taking a voyage down the Nile. Moving deeper into Egypt, he was further isolated from Rome, and Cleopatra was all the more seductive. The early 20th century lesbian seductress Natalie Barney had an on-again, off-again affair with the poet René Vivien. To regain her affections, she took René on a trip to the island of Lesbos, a place Natalie had visited many times. In doing so, she not only isolated René, but disarmed and distracted her with the associations of the place, the home of the legendary lesbian poet Sappho. Vivien even began to imagine that Natalie was Sappho herself. Do not take the target just anywhere. Pick the place that will have the most effective associations. The seductive power of isolation goes beyond the sexual realm. When new adherents joined Mahatma Gandhi's circle of devoted followers, they were encouraged to cut off their ties with the past, with their family and friends. This kind of renunciation has been a requirement of many religious sects over the centuries. People who isolate themselves in this way are much more vulnerable to influence and persuasion. A charismatic politician feeds off and even encourages people's feelings of alienation. John F. Kennedy did this to great effect when he subtly disparaged the Eisenhower years. The comfort of the 1950s, he implied, compromised American ideals. He invited Americans to join him in a new life on a new frontier, full of danger and excitement. It was an extremely seductive lure, particularly for the young, who were Kennedy's most enthusiastic supporters. Finally, at some point in the seduction, there must be a hint of danger in the mix. Your targets should feel that they are gaining a great adventure in following you, but are also losing something, a part of their past, their cherished comfort. Actively encourage these ambivalent feelings. An element of fear is the proper spice, although too much fear is debilitating. In small doses, it makes us feel alive. Like diving out of an airplane, it's exciting, a thrill, at the same time that it is a little frightening. And the only person there to break the fall or catch them is you. Reversal. The risks of this strategy are simple. Isolate someone too quickly, and you will induce a sense of panic that may end up in the targets taking flight. The isolation you bring must be gradual and disguised as pleasure, the pleasure of knowing you, leaving the world behind. In any case, some people are too fragile to be cut off from their base of support. The great modern courtesan, Pamela Harriman, had a solution to this problem. She isolated her victims from their families, their former or present wives, and in place of those old connections, she quickly set up new comforts for her lovers. She overwhelmed them with attention, attending to their every need. In the case of Averill Harriman, the billionaire who eventually married her, she literally established a new home for him, one that had no associations with the past and was full of the pleasures of the present. It is unwise to keep the seduced dangling in midair for too long with nothing familiar or comforting in sight. Instead, replace the familiar things you have cut them off from with a new home, a new series of comforts. Phase 3. The precipice. Deepening the effect through extreme measures. The goal in this phase is to make everything deeper. The effect you have on their mind, feelings of love and attachment, tension within your victims. With your hooks deep into them, you can push them back and forth between hope and despair until they weaken and snap. Showing how far you are willing to go for your victims, doing some noble or chivalrous deed, chapter 16, prove yourself, will create a powerful jolt, spark an intensely positive reaction. Everyone has scars, repressed desires, and unfinished business from childhood. Bring these desires and wounds to the surface, make your victims feel they're getting what they never got as a child, and you will penetrate deep into their psyche, stir uncontrollable emotions. Chapter 17, Effect a Regression. Now, you can take your victims past their limits, getting them to act out their dark sides, adding a sense of danger to your seduction. Chapter 18, Stir Up the Transgressive and Taboo. You need to deepen the spell, and nothing will more confuse and enchant your victims than giving your seduction a spiritual veneer. It's not lust that motivates you, but destiny. Divine Thoughts and Everything Elevated. Chapter 19. Use Spiritual Lures. The erotic lurks beneath the spiritual. Now, your victims have been properly set up. By deliberately hurting them, instilling fears and anxieties, you will lead them to the edge of the precipice from which it will be easy to push and make them fall. Chapter 20. Mix Pleasure with Pain. They feel great tension and are yearning for relief. Chapter 21. Chapter 16. Prove Yourself. Most people want to be seduced. If they resist your efforts, it's probably because you haven't gone far enough to allay their doubts about your motives, the depth of your feelings, and so on. One well-timed action that shows how far you are willing to go to win them over will dispel their doubts. Don't worry about looking foolish or making a mistake. Any kind of deed that is self-sacrificing and for your target's sake will so overwhelm their emotions they won't notice anything else. Never appear discouraged by people's resistance or complain. Instead, meet the challenge by doing something extreme or chivalrous. Conversely, spur others to prove themselves by making yourself hard to reach, unattainable, worth fighting over. Seductive evidence. Anyone can talk big, say lofty things about their feelings, insist on how much they care for us and also for all oppressed peoples in the far reaches of the planet. But if they never behave in a way that will back up their words, we begin to doubt their sincerity. Perhaps we're dealing with a charlatan or a hypocrite or a coward. Flattery and fine words can only go so far. A time will eventually arrive when you will have to show your victims some evidence to match your words with deeds. This kind of evidence has two functions. First, it allays any lingering doubts about you. Second, an action that reveals some positive quality in you is immensely seductive in and of itself. Brave or selfless deeds create a powerful and positive emotional reaction. Don't worry, your deeds don't have to be so brave and selfless that you lose everything in the process. The appearance alone of nobility will often suffice. In fact, in a world where people overanalyze and talk too much, any kind of action has a bracing, seductive effect. It's normal in the course of a seduction to encounter resistance. The more obstacles you overcome, of course, the greater the pleasure that awaits you. But many a seduction fails because the seducer doesn't correctly read the resistances of the target. More often than not, you give up too easily. First, understand a primary law of seduction. Resistance is a sign that the other person's emotions are engaged in the process. The only person you cannot seduce is somebody distant and cold. Resistance is emotional and can be transformed into its opposite, much as in jiu-jitsu, the physical resistance of an opponent can be used to make him fall. If people resist you because they don't trust you, an apparently selfless deed showing how far you're willing to go to prove yourself is a powerful remedy. If they resist because they are virtuous or because they are loyal to someone else, all the better. Virtue and repressed desire are easily overcome by action. As the great seductress Natalie Barney once wrote, "Most virtue is a demand for greater seduction." There are two ways to prove yourself. First, the spontaneous action. A situation arises in which the target needs help, a problem needs solving, or simply he or she needs a favor. You cannot foresee these situations, but you must be ready for them, for they can spring up at any time. Impress the target by going further than really necessary, sacrificing more money, more time, more effort than they had expected. Your target will often use these moments or even manufacture them as a kind of test. Will you retreat or will you rise to the occasion? You cannot hesitate or flinch even for a moment or all is lost. If necessary, make the deed seem to have cost you more than it has, never with words but indirectly, exhausted looks, reports spread through a third party, whatever it takes. The second way to prove yourself is the brave deed that you plan and execute in advance, on your own and at the right moment, preferably some way into the seduction, when any doubts the victim still has about you are more dangerous than earlier on. Choose a dramatic, difficult action that reveals the painful time and effort involved. Danger can be extremely seductive. Cleverly lead your victim into a crisis, a moment of danger, or indirectly put them in an uncomfortable position, and you can play the rescuer, the the gallant knight. The powerful feelings and emotions this elicits can easily be redirected into love. Some examples. Number 1. In France, in the 1640s, Marion de Lorme was the courtesan men lusted after the most. Renowned for her beauty, she had been the mistress of Cardinal Richelieu, among other notable political and military figures. To win her bed was a sign of achievement. For weeks, the rake, Count Gramont, had wooed de Lorme, and finally she had given him an appointment for a particular evening. The Count prepared himself for a delightful encounter, but on the day of the appointment, he received a letter from her, in which she explained in polite and tender terms her terrible regrets. She had the most awful headache and would have to stay in bed that evening. Their appointment would have to be postponed. The Count felt certain he was being pushed to the side for someone else, for de Lorme was as capricious as she was beautiful. Gramont did not hesitate. At nightfall, he rode to the Marais, where de Lorme lived, and scouted the area. In a square near her home, he spotted a man approaching on foot. Recognizing the Duc de Brissac, he immediately knew that this man was to supplant him in the courtesan's bed. Brissac seemed unhappy to see the Count, and so Gramont approached him hurriedly and said, "Brissac, my friend, you must do me a service of the greatest importance. I have an appointment, for the first time, with a girl who lives near this place, and as this visit is only to concert measures, I shall make but a very short stay. Be so kind as to lend me your cloak and walk my horse a little until I return, but above all, do not go far from this place." Without waiting for an answer, Gramont took the Duke's cloak and handed him the bridle of his horse. Looking back, he saw that Brissac was watching him, so he pretended to enter a house, slipped out through the back, circled around, and reached de Lorme's house without being seen. Gramont knocked at the door, and a servant, mistaking him for the Duke, let him in. He headed straight for the lady's chamber, where he found her lying on a couch in a sheer gown. He threw off Brissac's cloak, and she gasped in fright. "What's the matter, my fair one?" he asked. "Your headache, to all appearance, is gone?" She seemed put out, exclaimed she still had the headache, and insisted that he leave. It was up to her, she said, to make or break appointments. "Madam," Gramont said calmly, "I know what perplexes you. You are afraid lest Brissac should meet me here, but you may make yourself easy on that account." He then opened the window and revealed Brissac out in the square, dutifully walking back and forth with a horse like a common stable boy. He looked ridiculous. De Lorme burst out laughing, threw her arms around the Count, and exclaimed, "My dear Chevalier, I can hold out no longer. You are too amiable and too eccentric not to be pardoned." He told her the whole story, and she promised that the Duke could exercise horses all night, but she would not let him in. They made an appointment for the following evening. Outside, the Count returned the cloak, apologized for taking so long, and thanked the Duke. Brissac was most gracious, even holding Gramont's horse for him to mount and waving goodbye as he rode off. Interpretation: Count Gramont knew that most would-be seducers give up too easily, mistaking capriciousness or apparent coldness as a sign of a genuine lack of interest. In fact, it can mean many things. Perhaps the person is testing you, wondering if you're really serious. Prickly behavior is exactly this kind of test. If you give up at the first sign of difficulty, you obviously do not want them that much. Or it could be that they themselves are uncertain about you, or are trying to choose between you and someone else. In any event, it's absurd to give up. One incontrovertible demonstration of how far you're willing to go will overwhelm all doubts. It will also defeat your rivals, since most people are timid, worried about making fools of themselves, and so rarely risk anything. When dealing with difficult or resistant targets, it's usually best to improvise the way Gramont did. If your action seems sudden and a surprise, it will make them more emotional, loosen them up. A little roundabout accumulation of information, a little spying, is always a good idea. Most important is the spirit in which you enact your proof. If you're light-hearted and playful, if you make the target laugh, proving yourself and amusing them at the same time, it won't matter if you mess up or if they see you've employed a little trickery. They will give in to the pleasant mood you've created. Notice that the count never whined or grew angry or defensive. All he had to do was pull back the curtain and reveal the Duke walking his horse, melting Delorme's resistance with laughter. In one well-executed act, he showed what he would do for a knight of her favors. Number 2. Pauline Bonaparte, the sister of Napoleon, had so many affairs with different men over the years that doctors were afraid for her health. She could not stay with one man for more than a few weeks. Novelty was her only pleasure. After Napoleon married her off to Prince Camillo Borghese in 1803, her affairs only multiplied. And so, when she met the dashing major Jules de Canouville in 1810, everyone assumed the affair would last no longer than the others. Of course, the major was a decorated soldier, well-educated, an accomplished dancer, and one of the most handsome men in the army. But Pauline, 30 years old at the time, had had affairs with dozens of men who could have matched that resume. A few days after the affair began, the imperial dentist arrived, chez Pauline. A toothache had been causing her sleepless nights, and the dentist saw he would have to pull out the bad tooth right then and there. No painkillers were used at the time, and as the man began to take out his various instruments, Pauline grew terrified. Despite the pain of the tooth, she changed her mind and refused to have it pulled. Major Canouville was lounging on a couch in a silken robe. Taking all this in, he tried to encourage her to have it done. A moment or two of pain and it's over forever. A child could go through with it and not utter a sound, he said. I'd like to see you do it, she said. Canouville got up, went over to the dentist, chose a tooth in the back of his own mouth, and ordered that it be pulled. A perfectly good tooth was extracted, and Canouville barely batted an eyelash. After this, not only did Pauline let the dentist do his job, her opinion of Canouville changed. No man had ever done anything like this for her before. The affair had been going to last but a few weeks. Now it stretched on. Napoleon was not pleased. Pauline was a married woman. Short affairs were allowed, but a deep attachment was embarrassing. He sent Canouville to Spain to deliver a message to a general there. The mission would take weeks, and in the meantime, Pauline would find someone else. Canouville, though, was not your average lover. Riding day and night, without stopping to eat or sleep, he arrived in Salamanca within a few days. There he found that he could proceed no farther, since communications had been cut off, and so, without waiting for further orders, he rode back to Paris, without an escort, through enemy territory. He could meet with Pauline only briefly. Napoleon sent him right back to Spain. It was months before he was finally allowed to return, but when he did, Pauline immediately resumed her affair with him, an unheard-of act of loyalty on her part. This time, Napoleon sent Canouville to Germany, and finally to Russia, where he died bravely in battle in 1812. He was the only lover Pauline ever waited for, and the only one she ever mourned. Interpretation. In seduction, the time often comes when the target has begun to fall for you, but suddenly pulls back. Your motives have begun to seem dubious. Perhaps all you are after is sexual favors, or power, or money. Most people are insecure, and doubts like these can ruin the seductive illusion. In the case of Pauline Bonaparte, She was quite accustomed to using men for pleasure, and she knew perfectly well that she was being used in turn. She was totally cynical. But people often use cynicism to cover up insecurity. Pauline's secret anxiety was that none of her lovers had ever really loved her, that all of them, to a man, had really just wanted sex or political favors from her. When Canoville showed through concrete actions the sacrifices he would make for her, his tooth